Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:13 British Summer Time. Today is August 16th, and today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Now, if we have a review of what's been happening this week, then Wall Street pulled back rather sharply yesterday and sustained the decline in here today, with the S&P down about 4 points, which is about 0.25% towards the close. Europe this week saw a number of markets pushing on to new recovery highs. And while there's short-term overbought conditions evident on quite a considerable number of them, the tone is rather positive, in that the German market and the German economy and the French economy have exited recession and are growing once more, and that has pushed the Eurozone economy out of recession, because those represent the two largest members. That doesn't mean that Europe doesn't still have quite a considerable bad debt problem, and its banks remain in this rather awkward position, in that they've had a huge amount of money pumped into them, and yet they haven't really written off very many of the bad debts, and it leaves a certain amount of uncertainty. But what we are seeing is that the banking sector is outperforming in here relative to the wider market, and that in itself can be viewed as a positive. In Asia, the Japanese market continues to range, and it was a little bit weaker into the end of the week. And one can't mention the Japanese market without talking about the yen, and against the US dollar, the yen has been a little bit firmer in here, and it's currently trading around the 97.5 yen to the dollar region. So it continues to range in the region of the 100 yen to the dollar level. And as long as that remains the case, the chances are that the Japanese market is going to continue to range. The Chinese market today had a fat finger moment, and a number of shares rallied their limit, which is 10%, in the early part of the day. And when Everbright Securities announced that they had had a trading error, then the market gave up almost the entire advance to finish pretty much unchanged on the day. And these types of errors are becoming increasingly more frequent as the market deals are is increasingly dominated by automated trading systems, and that's unlikely to change anytime soon. Just as we saw with the flash crash in 2010 and a fat finger moment in the Indian market last year, the effect of these types of moves is damaging to confidence, and it is likely going to take a little bit of time for the market to digest exactly what was going on and readjust to the dynamics of supply and demand, which prior to this event had been growing progressively a little bit more optimistic. And the Chinese market continues to hold a progression of higher reaction lows and continues to be led higher by sectors that benefit from increasing consumerism and the rise of the middle class, and namely that is healthcare and consumer discretionary and the information technology sector. And India is another very interesting market. It represents the market that has got the second largest population, is likely to have the largest population in the world in the next decade or two, and one of the markets that has the greatest capability to lift millions of people out of poverty and into the middle classes. And it has this burgeoning corporate sector with excellent governance, and yet the government has been holding the market back and is plagued by inefficiency, bureaucracy and corruption. And perhaps paramount is the current account deficit, which is being mentioned on in terms of India in the same sentence on a daily basis. And the Indians have instituted these reforms where they're trying to stop people from buying gold and stop people from importing oil. And they believe that that is going to tame the current account deficit. And that's short-termism by definition. what really needs to happen is institutional reform and opening up of the economy and breaking down of the barriers to efficiency that have been built up over the years. And if those types of things occur, then the country will become a greater magnet for manufacturing, and that alone will help to improve the current account deficit. And really, until we start to see government bond yields starting to come back down, then that market is likely to remain under pressure. And the banking sector, which has been leading for the last 2 years, it led on the upside, it is most definitely leading on the downside, is remaining under pressure here and is being squeezed really rather intensely by the RBI. And it does look like we're going to see, we haven't seen yet any clear evidence that the pressure has been taken off the banking sector. And with improving economics in the USA, we saw that the speculation about tapering increased again this week. And the speculation about exactly what is going to happen with quantitative easing has been ebbing and flowing now for about the last 6 weeks. And what we are seeing is that US figures have been improving, and housing starts have been improving, and unemployment has been trending lower, albeit at a moderate pace and certainly not as quick as most people would have liked. And the competitive advantage that the US has in terms of its energy policy, and not least in the low price of natural gas, which as of the close today is trading at $3.37, when Brent crude is trading in excess of $100, that creates a really quite a wonderful arbitrage, and anyone who can use natural gas will use natural gas in this environment. And that represents a competitive advantage for the US, but also because people are shifting over to natural gas, it is helping to reduce the call on oil in terms of its imports, which is helping its own current account deficit. So with these types of things improving, we've seen that government bond yields have pushed higher from about 1.5% last year to 2.82% at the close in here today. And that was a breakout from the two-month range that we've seen in government bond yields in here this week. When we look at the 30-year bull market that has existed in US Treasuries, then we can see that it was pretty mature 5 years ago, and it was put on life support when quantitative easing was instituted. And investors all over the world followed on the coattails of the Fed and started buying these things. But with the mere mention that quantitative easing might be tapered, investors took that as a signal that the momentum trade in US Treasuries was over, and they started liquidating positions. And stock markets have been beneficiaries of that. But what this has really been about is the deleveraging of leverage positions. So we've seen some of the leverage taken off the table, and that means that that money hasn't been put back into other asset classes. And we've seen that government bond yields are now trending higher. And that is consistent with a benign result in terms of quantitative easing. And by benign, I think that what that falls into the category of is that if velocity of money, which has been trending lower since 1998, 1997, actually starts to turn upwards in the next year, then the need to have excessive monetary supply in the system is reduced considerably. And in fact, if the Fed wants to avoid an inflationary outcome, then they will need to remove some of that money from the system to cater for the pickup in velocity of money. And an increase in the velocity of money, and particularly on a sustained basis, could be equated with a return to self-sustained growth in the US economy. And If that is the case, then the commensurate short-term interest rate would naturally begin to rise, and that would translate into higher yields in terms of the government bond. We're starting to see the government bonds rising, and that has been driven higher by deleveraging. The unwinding of this massive momentum move that has happened in US Treasuries, we're a long way from quantitative easing being removed entirely. What we're really only starting to talk about is a reduction in the amount of new money being created. When we actually get to a position where they stop adding in new money and allowing some of the debt that has been taken out to expire and take some of that money out of the system, it could take a number of years. But we do have to think about how much leverage is each additional dollar that is created, how much leverage is that put under. So if tapering goes from 85 billion a month to, say, 60 billion, and you take that 25 billion of extra money and you start to invest it on a leveraged basis, then it starts to multiply. And as leverage trade gets put on leverage trade and it gets pumped through the shadow banking system, then when people start to think about how that money is going to be taken out and that leverage being unwound, the multiplying effect is starts to avalanche or to snowball. So that is why we're seeing government bond yields started to push higher in here. And we can anticipate that that is going to continue. And when you look at bonds on a total return basis, and considering that the vast majority of people that are buying bonds in the last 30 years were buying them for the yield and the capital appreciation combined for a total return. So when we look at the total return on those bonds, well, then that trend has had a major inconsistency. It's broken its progression of higher reaction lows. It's pulled back below the 200-day moving average and so far sustained that move. So it is looking increasingly likely that that bull market in bonds, which has lasted for more than 30 years, is over. And it means that in the absence of a momentum move to boost your total return in bonds, then there's going to be a need for a higher yield to compensate for the lack of momentum in terms of capital appreciation. And that also supports the argument for higher yields in terms of the government bond. And it isn't just US Treasuries. We're seeing that Canadian bonds are actually leading to the upside. And German Bunds, which have been the safe haven within the Eurozone, are also pushing higher in here. And we're seeing that the types of action that we're seeing right across US, Canadian, European, Swiss, British, Japanese bonds, it's very similar. And it does suggest that the massive bull market that we've had in bonds is definitely changing in here. And that deleveraging process isn't going to be without some hiccups along the way for other asset classes. With the speculation about whether the Fed is going to begin its tapering in September or not, the US dollar was quite a bit weaker in here today, and that helped to spur gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And gold was quite a bit stronger yesterday. It improved on that performance in here today. It broke upwards out of its most recent little range. And it has unwound more of its oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average. And that moving average is still in the region of about $1,400, which is approximately $25 from where gold is trading right now. A sustained move back above the 200-day moving average would greatly improve the possibility that a medium-term low has been found for gold in here. But what we have at least now seen is a larger rally. And this is the first larger rally that we've seen since prices were trading around $1,800 last September. What is also interesting is that the gold sector, the gold mining sector, which has been incredibly beaten down, and has been one of the worst performing stock market sectors of any sector in the last 18 months has returned to a position of outperformance. And a lot of the fat has been squeezed out of these gold miners, and they've been forced to introduce rationalization. And one might argue that they should have been doing that a number of years ago, but what we are now starting to see is that they've been hedging more of their production, and that hedging has been coming in at levels that were probably unimaginable 5 or 6 years ago. So the value in some of these gold miners and silver miners has improved really rather substantially, and they are one of the most deeply oversold sectors out there. But what we are seeing is that some of the sectors that have been so very oversold, and not least in the resources sector, and in the steel sector, and materials sector, and industrial materials, have found at least short-term support and are rallying. And we've seen that illiquid markets that are generally regarded as esoteric are now also starting to rally, and rally rather impressively, not least in the Middle East. And when you start to see these types of things, and we look at stock markets, and Wall Street has been rallying now for the bones of 4.5 years, then even though we're at new all-time highs, and we've characterized Wall Street since 2000 as being a generational-long process of P-ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, and we're in the latter stages of that. But also, we've had an incredible rally from the low at 666 up to 1655 at today's close. So 1,000 points on the S&P over the last 4 years, which is impressive by any measure. And some of the best performing sectors are trading a little bit expensive in here right now on a PE basis. So when people look at a market that is overextended relative to the 200-day moving average, and they think about something that is trading on single-digit PEs and in with a competitive yield, then they see catch-up potential. But that generally tends to create impressive rallies, but it also is a signal of a late-in-the-cycle move. And with government bond yields pushing higher in here, you don't have to look very far to see potential for at least a pause in stock markets, and potentially quite a good deal of ranging. And when we look at what happened back in 1965 all the way through to 1980, then we're presented with a similar process of P-ratio contraction, rising dividend yields, and then the market broke upwards in 1980 and ranged for 18 months. Now, we're in a very different scenario now, and we're in a disinflationary environment instead of an inflationary environment. But when we look at the potential for government bond yields to push higher, and for the liquidity that the market has thrived on over the last 4 years to begin to be withdrawn, then the potential for a good deal of ranging over the next year is the most likely scenario. But when we look beyond that, and we look at the long term, then we're living in one of the most exciting periods of human history. Has been in a very long period of time, and it's not such a stretch to call it a golden age. And if we look at how productivity is defined, then we have the greatest age of humanism that there's ever likely to be. There are more humans alive at the one time than there has ever been before, and more of them are moving out of abject poverty and into the middle classes and into the disposable income bracket, and that is creating ingenuity and productivity gains. The fact that a lot more of the global economy has adopted capitalism or capitalistic policies and is helping to unleash the productive capacity of their respective populations is not only increasing labor productivity, but is also creating an ever-increasing pool of educated people that can come up with the next big idea. And technological innovation is on an exponential growth curve. We're seeing Moore's Law, which helped to revolutionize microchips, being applied to an increasing number of technologies, not least what we've written a great deal about this week in the solar sector, but in medical devices, in biotechnology, in robotics, and in computer programming, we're seeing the same exponential growth. And with the confluence of these themes and the innovation that is happening in one sector, helping to promote innovation in another, and both of them increasing innovation in each other, then the potential for efficiencies to come through and for productivity gains to come through from technological innovation is pretty difficult to argue with. And that is likely to be a major growth driver in the next decade to two decades. And the energy revolution that that is likely to unleash is really beyond parallel. We are seeing already that the US is benefiting from its natural gas, and that shale revolution is likely to, an unconventional gas, is likely to go global in the next 10 to 15 years. So the arbitrage between oil and natural gas, or coal and natural gas, or uranium and natural gas, is going to go global as well. And it means that there's always going to be a call on oil, but there's going to be alternatives. And with the innovation that is happening in solar and the potential for massive innovation to come through and really out of the blue and change the cycle entirely, well, the potential for that to happen is increasing on a daily basis. We don't yet know exactly how much or how long it is going to take for massive efficiencies to come through and actually get implemented. But what is increasingly likely is that that is going to happen. So that natural gas, which represents an incredible bull market, and not least for its consumers, is likely to be a stopgap measure compared to the energy revolution that will follow it. So when we think about labor and technology and energy, they all represent massive technological boosts, productivity gains, and incredibly bullish factors for the post-quantitative easing world. And the debt burden that has been built up in developed markets in particular represents perhaps the greatest challenge. And as some of these markets get back to sustained growth, then the potential for interest rates to rise and for some of that debt to be choked off is quite high. And it does mean that the next year or the next 18 months is likely to have this ranging environment, which will see some of the valuations coming back to more attractive levels. And what we've all been conditioned by over the last decade has been to follow a trader's mantra. And that's changing. With the evolution of the autonomies, those companies that are leveraged to the global economy, leveraged to the growth of the global consumer, that have dominant brands and long records of increasing dividends, these are the types of companies that are going to benefit from the productivity gains that are coming through from these type from the themes we were just talking about. And in a higher interest rate environment, these are also the types of companies that will have dividend growth in excess of inflation and in excess of government bond yields, and also the potential for capital appreciation, so that equities are likely to become the go-to asset class in the next decade, the next two decades. Whereas in the last decade, the go-to asset class was bonds and commodities. Now, commodities at present are cheap, and there's plenty of them around. And we've also been presented with a global economy which has been growing at a subpar level. And the Eurozone in particular has been in recession. And China has been migrating from a very high growth environment to a more medium term or medium level growth type economy, which would be consistent with its per capita GDP. And that has put pressure on commodities. Now, if we return to more of a growth environment over the next few years, that should be generally bullish for commodities. But considering that we've had hundreds of billions invested in new supply, that some of that supply is now coming on track, and that consumers are becoming more efficient users of commodities, then they will have to be assessed on their individual merits rather than as an asset class more generally over the next decade, I believe. And what happened with gold this week is important, and the fact that investment demand for gold has been trending lower, and it still remains on a downward trajectory, although that has moderated considerably. And of course, it's not difficult to understand why the ETF holdings of gold have been trending lower when we hear that John Paulson has liquidated half his gold portfolio. That also represented a headwind for the market, and if he has already liquidated it, then that removes a headwind from the market, and we can see some of the shorts that were pressuring that market being unwound, and we can see further upside. But gold peaked at $1,900 and fell to $1,180. That's a substantial pullback, and that has really thinned out the number of people on the sidelines and the marginal buyer. And there is substantial potential for a short covering rally to continue and some additional upside. But significant technical damage has been done, and it is going to take time above all else to really start to reinvigorate the animal spirits in precious metals. But considering how far they have fallen and how much pressure the mining sector has been put on, and that we're back at the marginal cost of production, then there is potential for them to go higher from here. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and I wish all the best to all of you.